Union Pacific Railroad against the Regional Transportation Authority. Mr. Vincent.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Josh Vincent. I represent the Commuter Rail Authority of the Regional Commuter Rail Division of the Regional Transportation Authority, doing business as Metra. This is a declaratory judgment action in which we are challenging the district court's ruling that the Union Pacific Railroad has no common carrier obligation to continue providing passenger rail service on three Metra lines once its purchase of services agreement expires. It's very tempting to start this argument with the question of subject matter jurisdiction, because our briefs have uncovered a circuit split on that question as to whether the courts have concurrent jurisdiction over questions arising under the Termination Act, or whether the Surface Transportation Board has exclusive jurisdiction over questions involving the violation. But before we can get to that issue, we have raised a question about whether an Article III case or controversy has been presented in this case, and we think that there is not. The parties' briefs agree that the Supreme Court's decision in MedImmune is controlling. Union Pacific contends this case is identical. We contend this case couldn't be more different than MedImmune. For starters, the declaratory judgment in MedImmune involved a question of law that actually decided the party's rights and obligations under the patent license agreement. The declaratory judgment by Judge Alonzo in this case doesn't decide any right or obligation of the parties under the contract, the purchase of services agreement, whatsoever. All it affects is the party's bargaining position, because what we have, according to the complaint, is an impasse that has been reached in contract negotiations between Union Pacific and Metra over the cost of Union Pacific continuing to provide service. And of course, Union Pacific wants more money than Metra is willing to pay, and Metra responded by saying that if they don't reach an agreement, Union Pacific will nonetheless owe an obligation to provide passenger service.
So, Mr. Vincent, with regard to this issue, what if Union Pacific sent Metra a letter saying that we don't believe that we have an obligation to continue passenger service on these tracks, and so therefore we will cease our operations in 7 days. Mm-hmm. See you later.
Yep.
Okay.
Sounds a lot like the last case.
And so would that be sufficient to create a case in controversy?
No, I don't think it would, Your Honor, because there's too
so,
many.
So you need to wait to have Union Pacific actually on that day say, okay, we're done.
Yes, I think that's what it would have to come down to. And I think part of the problem here is that there, you know, the MedImmune case.
So the main use of the Declaratory Judgment Act since its enactment is forbidden. Somebody says, I would like to do X. And they say they'll arrest me if I do X. Please give me a declaratory judgment that I'm entitled to do X.
Judge, it's a
That's
question.
A perfectly normal lawsuit.
I totally agree. I mean, that's no question. That's
so
all.
So Union Pacific says, we say we're entitled to stop service.
Yes.
And Metra says, you're not so entitled. We'd like a declaratory judgment. How is that any different from, I would like to peddle my wares without a license. You say you'll arrest me if I don't have a license.
I don't think it's the same level of coercion. I mean, that's the test. It's a question of degree under MedImmune as to how coercive it is. And at this point, there's too many things that could happen. As the district court pointed out, if they don't reach a contract, Metra could take over the service. If they don't reach a contract, Metra might find another entity to operate the trains. If they may negotiate and reach a contract. The problem here is that the declaratory judgment is preventing a contract from being reached. That's ultimately what's happening here. It's changing the party's negotiating position and the economic dynamic that would normally exist. I mean, I can't imagine any simple transaction where there's a merger agreement and people dispute whether something's going to be entitled to tax treatment depending on when the transaction closes. Parties don't go to the court and ask for an advisory opinion on that because they risk the fact that tax treatment might be different depending on how the case closes.
I believe I've seen cases like that. And these days, the most common declaratory judgment action is somebody says to an insurance company, you must defend and indemnify me in lawsuit X.
Yes.
The insurance company says, no, we have no such legal obligation.
Yes.
The insurance company then files an action for a declaratory judgment.
Correct.
That and it has no such legal obligation.
That's right. And
well, here we have Union Pacific saying we have no legal obligation as a common carrier to run these trains. And Metra says, yes, you do. And here we are. I think perhaps you should move to your next point.
Okay. The only thing I would add to it, Judge, is that I don't think that the declaratory in this context really is the correct party either. From the standpoint that it's really the citizens of Illinois.
Let's move to your next point.
The subject matter jurisdiction issue.
It's not a question of subject matter jurisdiction. It's one of agency primary jurisdiction, which is not subject matter jurisdiction. But it is important, and it's something a court should raise. Do we have the view of the Surface Transportation Board about whether it has primary jurisdiction over this kind of dispute?
For purposes of the declaratory judgment, the Surface Transportation Board jurisdiction would be discretionary. That's different. But for purposes of a violation...
Look, I asked a concrete question, and I wish you'd answer the question I asked.
Sure.
Do we have the view of the Surface Transportation Board about whether it has primary jurisdiction over a dispute like this?
No, I don't believe we do.
What then do you make of the Surface Transportation Board's order on July 22nd, 2020, granting Union Pacific's motion to hold the proceedings in abeyance?
Well, as I said, I think that with respect to a declaratory judgment, the board's jurisdiction is discretionary, and that's the basis on which it dismissed it, is that it decided it did not.
That order doesn't seem to exclusively be about a declaratory judgment. It seems to say we are willing to wait because the district court might grant Metra's motion. The district court might resolve the common carrier issue. We don't need to. It might eliminate board action. That sounds to me like an acknowledgement of concurrent jurisdiction. Why do you read it differently?
I read it differently because the D.C. Circuit's decision in McCarty versus Surface Transportation Board found that the courts have no jurisdiction over disputes under the Termination Act. The jurisdiction
a decision of the D.C. Circuit and $3 will get you a cup of coffee at Starbucks. The question I asked, the question Judge Jackson Acumi asked, is do we have the definitive position of the Surface Transportation Board?
No, I don't.
You might think it's, and then could you help me, because I didn't see your answer to her question about why that 2020 ruling is not sufficient.
Because I don't know how else to answer it, Judge, other than to say that I view the Surface Transportation Board decision as simply a refusal to exercise its discretion. It characterized the matter before it as being discretionary as to whether it had to hear it or not, and it decided not to, and to defer to
the district. Do you think we need an amicus brief from the Surface Transportation Board?
I certainly would welcome one. I think that in this
case... Why do you think it would say anything different from the 2020 order?
Because I think we would have an opportunity to talk to the Surface Transportation Board about what we view as the correct interpretation of Sections 10501 and 11704 in terms of establishing exclusive jurisdiction in the agency for any dispute that arises under the Termination Act, and the court's role is really only the enforcement of the agency's decisions. I think that's consistent with the history of how the Illinois Interstate Commerce Act and now the Termination Act have been applied over the years. The court, since as early as the Supreme Court, since 1907, in the Abilene Cotton case, found that although it was characterized then as primary jurisdiction, that in every instance, when you trace that all the way through from 1907 to 1966, the courts have deferred to the agency in these circumstances for purposes of questions of interpreting the act or applying the act, and found that the court's role is appropriately to wait in abeyance and to enforce. And what I think Congress did when it enacted first 11704 11705 in 1978, and then 10501, was to establish, make it very concrete, that the practice in which the courts were then engaged, which was to allow the agency to make the determinations and the court's role to enforce it, was made concrete with those two provisions in 1978 and 1980. And I think that that's why the D.C. Circuit case is is basically on point in terms of deciding under the plain language of the statute, and this is a plain language question that arises under the Termination Act, as to what these terms mean. I mean, this would read the word exclusive right out of 10501. There's a reason it says exclusive, and it doesn't say exclusive primary. I mean, that's sort of along the lines of what the Fifth Circuit tried to say in the Elam case, where it defines exclusive primary to mean it's the only place where there's primary jurisdiction, but that's a misreading of it. There's, you know, there's either exclusive jurisdiction or there's primary jurisdiction, and Congress chose the word exclusive for purposes of deciding violations under the Termination Act. With respect to enforcement, it made it very clear that enforcement takes place in the court, and that's the court's role. And when you look at the cases that Union Pacific is relying upon here, which is the Pajopska case out of the First Circuit, there's two problems with that. First, it did not consider the D.C. Circuit's decision. It overlooked it, the McCarty Farms decision. And second, it misreads Section 11704, because 11704, when it, you know, to enforce liability against a carrier, it reads that to mean to sue for a violation. And that is not the natural reading in the context of this particular statute. It's to enforce a liability found by the STB under 10501. There's no redundancy. The court said that this was ambiguous, and there's a redundancy in 105C1 and C2. I'm sorry, 11704, C1 and C2, but there's no redundancy there. It talks distinctly about a difference between enforcing a liability and enforcing damages. They are not the same. And when you look at how the statutory language has evolved, there is a clear modification of what was formerly Section 9, then became 11705, now 11704. It was originally saying for the recovery, you could bring an action in either the agency or the court for the recovery of damages for which such carrier may be liable, whereas now it says simply to enforce liability. And those are very distinct concepts. So to go back to your question, I think that I feel confident the Surface Transportation Board, with some input from us, would find correctly that its jurisdiction is exclusive over any interpretation or application of the Termination Act, and that the court's role is limited to enforcement of it. I think what's happened here is it's become, you know, it's really come full circle. The practice of the courts in deferring and letting the agencies decide it and playing the role of enforcement has been made concrete by the Congress with those two enactments in 1978 and 1980, which are now part of the Termination Act. The merits of this case, if you reach the merits, and I don't believe the court should, but the question here is also very much like the subject matter jurisdiction question, a straight up issue of statutory interpretation. The Section 11101 of the Termination Act provides that a rail carrier providing transportation or service subject to the STB's jurisdiction, quote, shall provide the transportation on reasonable request. 10903, which is the discontinuance provision, provides a general rule. It says an abandonment or discontinuance may be carried out only as authorized under this chapter, and there are only two authorizations under this chapter. One is to abandon any part of a line, and one is to discontinue all transportation over any part of a line. There is nothing in the statute that says a carrier is authorized to keep a line and shed services piecemeal or partially discontinue service over that line, whether it's passenger
what
or freight
What is it in
service.
The statute that forbids that? It used to be forbidden by Section 10908, but that was repealed.
Correct. So it's forbidden because the Congress removed the authorization for the STB to allow a partial discontinuance.
Yep, but what forbids a railroad from discontinuing a particular service over a line that remains in use?
The STB has no authority to allow it.
That just may mean the Surface Transportation Board is out of that business, just like the Civil Aeronautics Board is now out of the business of telling airlines which city pairs they must serve. What is it in the statute that forbids a railroad from deciding, for example, not to run the 5 o'clock freight train that it used to run every day?
I think it's the way Congress has structured this, Your Honor, is that you cannot allow the railroads to piecemeal shed services to the point where...
What is it in the statute that says that? That's the question.
To me,
right? 10908 and 10909 used to say that.
Correct.
We all agree they've been repealed.
Correct.
So one now looks for something in the statute that says that.
Well, I don't think that Congress needed to explicitly say they can't do it. They removed the authority to allow it to happen. And I think, you know, when Congress, I think a good example of when
all
Congress...
All right, I take it your answer is nothing. I'm asking you to point to something in the statute that forbids it. Forget about passenger service. Forget about common carrier. A railroad for 50 years has run two freight trains a day over a particular stretch of track.
It's the, okay. It's
just
the,
listen to the question.
Sure.
And it decides it will now run only one freight train over that stretch of track. Does that need federal permission? Is it legally forbidden?
No, but it's required to continue to provide it under 11101 under the common carrier obligation, which requires it to continue providing.
You're begging
service.
The question.
I'm not assuming a premise here, Your Honor. I'm reading the statute as written that 11101 imposes a common carrier obligation that the common carrier cannot simply rid itself of without authorization from the board. And the board has removed any authority to allow that type of partial discontinuance. And if you allow that to occur, then you create a situation where, for example, in the Chicago area, railroads would be able to say, well, we're going to stop carrying steel. We're going to stop carrying wheat. We're only going to carry grapes.
And what is it in the statute that forbids that?
The absence of authority, the language, the change here, that an abandoned or continuance may only be carried out as authorized under this chapter.
You just want us to define abandonment your way rather than the way that the ICC and the Surface Transportation Board have defined it since 1887. As ending all service on a line.
Well, that's really
this was not a big problem, right? Earlier,
that's
before 1995, if a railroad wanted to reduce the number of trains from one to two, it could. It needed no federal permission whatsoever.
Well,
why do you think it now needs federal permission? That's what puzzles me.
I think
1995 is a deregulatory step. And your argument is that by removing two sources of federal regulation, Congress actually increased the amount of federal regulation and indeed altogether forbade certain kinds of private decisions.
I think that the deregulation ended in 1995, to be honest with you. I think from 1958 to 1995 is when you saw the deregulation occur. It was during that period of time that Congress created the ability
for the railroads to get out of this service. The word abandonment is a word with a long, long history in railroad regulation.
Yes.
And you don't appear to be using it the way it's been used since 1887. I mean, why? Why does abandonment now have your special meaning?
Because at this point in time, the Congress has limited the circumstances under which an abandonment can occur.
No, that's why I say you're begging the question. I said, why does abandonment have your special meaning? And you said, that's because abandonment has my special meaning, because you just used abandonment your way.
No,
abandonment, sir. Since 1887, meant ending all service over a line.
Correct.
Union Pacific doesn't propose to abandon a line in that sense.
Correct.
It proposes to give up, to cease a particular service. Why does that count as abandonment, given the history of the meaning of that term?
Well, because now, at this point in time, the statute, oh, I'm sorry, I mean, you may feel this is circular, Your Honor, but the point is that the statute provides that there can only be a total abandonment at this point. There's one relief valve, and that's 10502. If Union Pacific wants to shed a portion of its passenger service, then that's the option that it has. It can go to the Surface Transportation Board and seek an exemption under 105.
Has the Surface Transportation Board ever used the word abandonment as you are using it in this litigation?
I don't know the answer to that question.
You know, it's It's the successor of an agency that began in 1887, the very first federal agency. And you would think that sometime between 1887 and 2022, if your position is right, the agency would have said that by abandonment, we mean, and the statute means, any change whatsoever reducing service to any extent. I'm not aware of any such declaration by the agency.
My time has expired.
As long as we're asking questions, you can keep giving answers.
I didn't understand what the question was there.
All right. I think we're done. Mr. Dupre.
Good morning. Thank you, Judge Easterbrook. And may it please the court, Tom Dupre on behalf of Union Pacific. Nothing in the law imposes a common carrier mandate on Union Pacific that would compel us to operate Metra's trains once the contract between the parties has expired. To begin with, Union Pacific is not a common carrier of passengers.
Let me ask you the two principal questions that I asked Mr. Vinson. First, do we have the views of the board on this issue?
We do, Your Honor. Document 62, ECF District Court Docket. That is the decision in which the Surface Transportation Board, that's the district court decision reporting on the Surface Transportation Board's decision to hold the case in abeyance rather than exercise primary jurisdiction. Metra went to the Surface Transportation Board and basically said, we want you, STB, to decide this in lieu of the district court. The Surface Transportation Board says, no, the district court is exercising jurisdiction. There's concurrent jurisdiction between the board and the district court, and we are going to hold our fire and let the district court decide this. Then in document
60- And then presumably second guess the district court?
Well, I don't think
Let's see if we can render the district court's opinion advisory.
Well, I hope that's not where we are. It's not that sort of agency, Your Honor. I think what the Surface Transportation Board was simply saying is the district court has concurrent jurisdiction. It's not something within its primary jurisdiction, because primary jurisdiction typically concerns highly technical, granular, detailed questions, which this is not. This is a pure question of law about the extent of a common carrier obligation. But to Your Honor's question, Judge Easterbrook, where you said, is it worth soliciting the STB for an amicus brief? That's in fact what the district court did. That's document 62. The district court, citing this court's precedent, said it may be helpful to get an amicus brief if the Surface Transportation Board has a different view. The district court said, I am inferring from the STB's decision that it's happy allowing this court to exercise jurisdiction, otherwise it wouldn't have held the case in abeyance, but out of an abundance of caution, in case I'm mistaken and pursuant to this court's precedent, let me invite the Surface Transportation Board to weigh in with its own amicus brief if I'm mistaken about that. And they never did. So I think in answer to Your Honor's question, we know the STB's view on this. It couldn't have been clearer. The district court made the exact invitation this court contemplated. The STB declined the invitation. There's no question what the STB's view of this is. Let me address the...
All right. My second principal question is, has the Surface Transportation Board or its predecessor, the Interstate Commerce Commission, use the word abandonment to mean reduction of service on a line rather than ending service on a line?
No, Your Honor. I, too, was very puzzled by my friend's argument. It never has. That's not what abandonment means. Your Honor hit the nail on the head.
Never,
abandonment has...
Never is a long time. Have you done a search?
I cannot say I have...
I will tell you, I used to be the Interstate Commerce Commission's lawyer. And it has said a lot of things since it was created in 1887. You really need to do a search on this. So I'm asking if you've done a search.
Let's see. I have not, precisely because abandonment, at least the way that the courts have described it, there's a Judge Kavanaugh opinion as the D.C. Circuit where he described it. I mean, as Your Honor recognized, it's a term of art in railroad law. It has a fixed meaning. I am certainly not aware of any decision, you know, in the 1800s, 1900s, to that, at any point where there's been a different meaning given to abandonment. I mean, I think the plain English version of abandonment means you abandon something. That's not what we're doing here.
Plain English is the very last thing one would think of in dealing with the Interstate Commerce Commission Act and its successor. They didn't seem capable of resolving any dispute in fewer than 200 pages. It was just not in their power.
Let me ask you this, counsel. What section of the ICCTA do you rely on in claiming that you have no obligation to, in claiming that your obligation to provide passenger service was eliminated? In other words, are you and your friend on the other side, merely on the other two sides of a coin here?
No, Your Honor. And if I could answer Your Honor's question in two parts. The first is our primary point, and I think, frankly, the easiest way for this court to resolve that question is to look at the 1995 decision of the ICC, in which the ICC said the Chicago Northwestern, our predecessor, is not a common carrier of passengers. Full stop. This issue was litigated by Metra, which, by the way, that was the position they were advancing, that we're not a common carrier, and the ICC agreed with it and held our predecessor was not a common carrier. So that's the first point. If, hypothetically, there were some residual common carrier mandate that could have survived that, again, I don't see how it could since the ICC definitively decided this very question in 1995, I think it would go to Judge Easterbrook's point, which is that historically, or at least in the period in the 1960s, and I did prior to ICTA, you did need permission.
Prior to what?
It was an acronym, Your Honor. I failed the test. The Interstate Commerce Commission Termination Act.
Just refer to it as the Act.
The Act. Prior to the Act, as Judge Easterbrook noted, a carrier, if they wanted to discontinue part of a service or stop providing passenger services, needed to go and get permission. When Congress enacted the Act in 1995, it deleted those provisions. And so just as there's nothing that says you have to provide this passenger service, there's nothing that says in order to divest yourself of the passenger service, you have to get permission from the government.
So, in essence, both of you are relying on the absence of a provision, but it just in different ways. Let me ask you this. If we don't buy your claim that passenger and freight obligations are severable in the statute, I think that's really at the core of what you need to argue. Does your argument still carry the day?
It does, Your Honor, but if I could just quickly respond when you said we're two sides of the same coin, I guess with respect, I would see it differently in that I think the background rule here is that just as a general matter of law, a company is not forced to engage in some sort of business or service absent some sort of government mandate that it did. And that it does. And so if the law is totally silent, in other words, if they can't even point to a provision in the law saying you have to pass this service, have to offer this service, that's the end of the analysis. In other words, I don't think the background rule in American law is unless the government says you don't need its permission not to do something, you're forbidden from doing it. I mean, no, we are entitled to terminate passenger service unless there's something in federal law that requires us to provide it or says you can only terminate it under certain circumstances. So again, that's why I don't think we're quite the same. They don't even come up with that threshold point putting this common carrier burden on us. So we don't even get to the question of, well, can you point to something that says you can release yourself from it? With regard to Your Honor's second question about freight and passenger, here too, I think, and I'm sure Judge Easterbrook will weigh in if I have this wrong, but I think it has been very well settled historically that the common carrier obligation separates freight common carrier obligations from passenger common carrier obligations. And so even if you are a carrier that is offering freight services, that obligation doesn't then require you to also offer passenger services and vice versa. So it's a different thing. We are a freight common carrier, to be sure, but the critical point and the question before this court is, are we a passenger common carrier? And I think the answer to that is clearly no. Certainly that was the ICC decision in 1995, which I would think is binding on this court.
Counsel, how do you address the concern raised by Metra with regard to the fact that if we accept your proposed interpretation of the Act, that would allow basically piecemeal discontinuances to add up to total abandonment? Is there a limiting principle there?
Well,
today, UP says, okay, well, we're going to stop offering passenger service, and then, you know, we'll keep a little bit of our freight service, but we're going to get rid of most of it. You know, is there, what would provide any sort of limitation of Metra basically just eating away all of the service until there's very little, if anything, left?
Well, I guess a few points, Your Honor. The first is that I think it would be a mistake to assume that even if you had a situation where one railroad was discontinuing particular trains, that there would be kind of a trainless gap, as it were. In other words, even if the court were to rule in our favor in this case, that doesn't mean that there's going to be no longer any commuter service on these lines. I mean, to the contrary. I mean, Metra, in all likelihood, will continue providing the service, just using a different independent contractor to provide it.
Well, I guess that's not my question. So, you're answering it from the perspective of the consumer. I'm asking the question from the perspective of UP as a business entity. It says, look, you know, we can't abandon our services on this line, but you know what? We can just eat away at it till it's basically down to nothing. What would limit the UP from doing that?
I think the common carrier mandate, at least on the freight side, certainly would. In other words, in Your Honor's hypothetical, let's say Union Pacific shipped, you know, 20 types of commodities, and again, to Your Honor's hypothetical, said, we want to chip away piecemeal at this, and, you know, we want to stop carrying, you know, barley. We want to stop carrying this commodity, chipping away piecemeal. I think at some point, maybe early on in the process, the common carrier mandate would come in, because the common carrier mandate, again, freight carriage, would say you're not allowed to discriminate in that way. If you have a reasonable request for services, you are reasonably required to provide it, and that sort of thing. So I think that would be a backstop to Your Honor's concern, that we would kind of whittle away so at the end of the day we would be carrying only, you know, the single most profitable commodity. Quite the contrary. I think the common carrier mandate would provide a backstop to the precise concern Your Honor articulated.
So if we find that UP on these facts is a common carrier of passenger service and we agree with Metra on that point, then UP would not have the ability to discontinue its passenger service without getting permission from the STB?
No, Your Honor. In other words, if hypothetically you were to find, again, contrary to all reason in the ICC's decision, that we were a common carrier, I think to Judge Easterbrook's point that we are free under the Act as it currently exists to discontinue that service, the passenger service, as long as we stop short of a total discontinuance or an abandonment.
But I guess I'm confused then. I thought the common carrier service obligation you said would impose would provide a backstop to you stopping a if you're a common carrier of, say, freight service or passenger service, of completely discontinuing it altogether.
It depends on the type of Your Honor's hypothetical in terms of a piecemeal dismantlement. In other words, the hypothetical that I was engaging with was the hypothetical where a carrier wanted to kind of, you know, stop transporting particular commodities piecemeal to get the most profitable one. The hypothetical Your Honor posited would be, if we had both freight and passenger, is there anything that would complete us, that would prohibit us from divesting passenger while maintaining the freight? The answer to that is no. The answer to that is no. But again, I that's entirely consistent with the Act that Congress provided, and of course the court doesn't even need to reach that question because we're not even a common carrier to begin with.
I'm interested in something you said in response to Judge Lee, which is that if Union Pacific gets out of this business, Metra is free to run trains itself or hire some third party to run them. Does Union Pacific agree that it has an obligation to let Metra use its track?
I don't think there's a legal obligation to make it use its track, but it would be.
But there is doubtless a price at which Union Pacific will find this profitable.
Obviously, Metra would have to pay, you know, reasonable fees for using our tracks, which are also used in freight service.
What does reasonable fee mean?
Well, this is getting, you know, above my knowledge level in terms of the amount that they're charging. But my point is that I don't think there would be any concern of the parties not ultimately being able to reach an agreement, at least in the sense that Metra already has agreements in place with other carriers in the Chicago area on their line. So these are precisely the types of agreements that Metra has negotiated in the past, is authorized by statute to negotiate. So that sort of framework in which Metra operates trains on tracks that are owned by freight carriers is extremely common.
I think the presence of this dispute today shows that Metra is very obviously concerned about having to reach an agreement with Union Pacific to use its rails while Metra takes over operation itself or contracts with a third party to do so. They'd much rather have you all keep doing it. That's why they're struggling so hard. So I don't know if I would go that far.
Well, I agree that they would like us to to continue doing it. But I think that stops short of saying, well, and if you are unable to reach an agreement, do you, Union Pacific, have a legal obligation to continue providing those services?
I hope you can see the problem. If it is not possible for Union Pacific and Metra to reach an agreement for Union Pacific to continue running the train, running Metra's stock, why would it be any easier to reach an agreement about the price Union Pacific would charge Metra to operate its own stock over this line in the same way?
Well, I guess a couple points, Your Honor. I guess the first point is that I think the parties would agree that one of the reasons why the negotiations over a new contract reached an impasse is because of the disagreement over this legal issue about whether you have a continuing obligation to do it regardless of whether you have a contract.
I hate to use the words here since we are not officially in law school, but the words Coase theorem come to mind. The rule of law doesn't really matter as long as the price term is open. If there is a price that Metra can pay to run its trains over Union Pacific's track, then there is a price it can pay for Union Pacific to run its trains over its track. Why are these two things any different?
Well, I think Metra clearly has a preference, all other things being equal, which they may not, to continue having Union Pacific operate its trains. Union Pacific does not want to continue to operate Metra's trains. And
you're not answering my question. Maybe it's not answerable, or maybe it's just a business question in which the business people have not confided in their lawyer.
Well, I wouldn't rule that possibility out, Judge Easterbrook. But I would also say that in this case, I think the question before this court is whether to affirm the declaratory judgment issued by the district court, namely whether we have a common carrier obligation. And I think regardless of the state of negotiations or how this will play out or the optimum price, I think the answer to the question that is before this court is abundantly clear. We have no common carrier obligation, period. If we did hypothetically have some sort of common carrier obligation that we somehow inherited from our predecessor, notwithstanding the ICC's decision that they were not a common carrier themselves, I think there's nothing in the law, in the Act, or anywhere else in federal law that would prevent us from discontinuing passenger service without seeking government permission. So as to that question before the court, again, we simply ask this court affirm the declaratory judgment of the court.
No, look, I understand the argument that Metra is saying the power to authorize the discontinuation of passenger service has been repealed. So the board can't authorize the discontinuation of the service. If that is right, then presumably Metra will be able to compel Union Pacific to run its trains for an annual payment of 10 cents, right? Because Union Pacific can't stop, and 10 cents is better than nothing. The business case for that would need to be made out, but that seems to be Metra's legal position. If Union Pacific cannot stop, we don't have to pay it a market price.
Again, I don't know what Metra's ultimate position is. I mean, I think at some point you're probably getting into Fifth Amendment territory, candidly, if Metra is going to say that we have a right to take your property and use your property for something that falls dramatically below actual compensation.
The Tucker Act would treat this, if it is a taking, it would be a taking by the United States for denying Union Pacific the power to abandon. And there would be a remedy against the United States in the Court of Federal Claims. That's the holding of the Regional Rail Reorganization Act cases in 1975. As I said, I was once the commission's lawyer.
I appreciate that, Your Honor, and I'm hopeful we will not reach that point. But unless there are any further questions, either as to the jurisdictional questions or as to the common carrier substantive questions, we would simply ask that this court affirm the judgment of the district court.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.